Welcome back, everybody, to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I'm your host, Ronak.
And I'm your other host, Greg.
So, Greg, today I think we got a pretty interesting episode. But before we delve into it, let me ask you a quick question. If you were going to think of who the most powerful person in the world is, are there maybe like two or three top names that immediately come to mind for you?
Most powerful person. Interesting. I feel like I would have to go with the current U.S. president, whoever that sitting president is. So we'll go with Biden for one. I'd probably then go with kind of, probably, what is it, Xi Jinping, Chinese communist leader. And third, I'd probably go with whoever the richest man in the world is, which I think is still Bernard Arnault. There you go.
I think that's fair. That's a fair list. I might throw in like maybe a Vladimir Putin in there, maybe a Donald Trump, maybe an Elon Musk. But, you know, we read about these folks in the news almost every single day. They're always making headlines. But if you take a step back and really think about the most powerful person in the world, do you really think that they want their name in the headlines all the time? I mean, if you're really the puppet master of the world, do you really want to be on the cover of TMZ magazine every other day? Or do you want to be a little bit hidden? The public doesn't know you who you are, so that way you can continue pulling the strings. Doesn't that make a little bit of sense?
I honestly think that's the best case scenario, right? So being a super powerful person or super wealthy person, but nobody in the world knows that you're actually that person.
Right.
That sounds like a nice little superpower to have, like an invisibility cloak.
Mm-hmm. So that brings me to today's topic, which is the company BlackRock. I actually think that a guy by the name of Larry Fink might actually be the most powerful person in the world. So Larry Fink is the founder and CEO of BlackRock. BlackRock is an investment management company that was started in 1988. So quite a while ago. You know, you have many assets. Mine too. And actually, Larry Fink went to UCLA, just like you and me as well. So maybe this
undergrad?
Is a little foretelling. Undergrad and MBA.
Okay.
Yeah,
surprised it's not called the Larry Fink School of Business.
Right.
It's the Anderson School of Business.
Right. I think this goes back to keeping your name a little bit hidden. BlackRock is super interesting. So on this podcast, we talked a little bit before about Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway and how this is an amazing investment company that's compounded returns fantastically over the decades. And we talked about one of their best investments that they've ever made was Apple, where they own something around 5.5% of the company. Do you remember this, Greg? Like Warren Buffett investing in Apple, owning about 5 to 6%, and that was his biggest investment.
He had to be convinced to invest in Apple. He's not a big tech guy until Apple.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, let me run through a quick list of some of the investments that BlackRock owns, okay? So let's start with Apple. They own 6% of Apple, so more than Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway. They also own 6% of Amazon, 8% of Johnson & Johnson, 7% of McDonald's, 6.5% of JP Morgan, 6% of Google, 7% of Microsoft, 3% of Tesla, 8% of Pfizer, 5% of Disney, 7% of Uber, 6% of Bank of America, 7% of ExxonMobil. And Greg, let me tell you, the list just goes on and on and on. This is an impressive list. So let me just give you a little bit of context of how much value they own. Their total assets under management is around $10 trillion. So the world's GDP, the entire globe's GDP, is roughly $95 trillion. So let's round up and say $100 trillion. So that means this one firm kind of in some way owns 1/10 of the entire world. Right. So just to put that in a little bit more perspective, the US's GDP is around 26 trillion. China is at about 19 trillion. And then you have BlackRock at about 10 trillion. And then you have Japan, Germany, India, the UK, France, and everybody else. So this is a giant, giant company that
caveat
most people
though,
have
Ronak,
not heard. Yeah.
GDP is an annual measurement.
Mm-hmm.
BlackRock is total assets under management.
Mm-hmm.
To date, correct? It's not necessarily like they have 10 trillion in new assets under management this year, like the GDP
correct?
No. GDP is actually a calculation that's done every year, and the growth of it changes every year. So it grows by 1% or 2% or 3% every year, but it is not a yearly, it's not like revenue where it's a yearly thing. It's like market cap where it's like a fixed amount in a period of time.
Oh, it's more like a market cap, GDP?
That's right. It's closer to a market cap than revenue. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Then my question for you, Ronak, now that I've done a little sleuthing, why is BlackRock's market cap only $99 billion?
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Same thing. So Larry Fink, he's worth about $1 billion, which is, of course, a lot of money, just like the market cap of BlackRock is a lot of money, but it's nothing compared to the valuation of Amazon,
Berkshire,
and
Berkshire.
Jeff Bezos.
I looked up Berkshire, $703 billion market cap. Yeah.
Right.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know much about BlackRock, so this is all going to be a new episode for me too.
Good. Perfect. Yeah. So, I mean, this goes back to my whole idea that I think that if you want to be the most powerful person in the world, you want to do it in a stealth way. And I think it's pretty clear that Larry Fink is, as we'll get into it, he's more driven by power than money. So let's first get into how they have $10 trillion of assets under management, right? Like, shouldn't we all, I mean, if they own 10% of the world, it should be pretty clear how they've been able to pull this off. And it's actually pretty tricky how they pulled this off. So in the last few decades, ETFs, exchange traded funds, have become a pretty big thing in the world. Greg, have you ever invested in an ETF?
Well, yes, I have. Most of my brokerage account is in a mixture of ETFs. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So maybe you've heard of an S&P 500 ETF, you know, let's say VOO or SPY, right? We all know it's a basket of about 500 of the biggest companies in America. You can just buy and sell the SPY or VOO very easily in any Charles Schwab or Fidelity brokerage account. Click a button, own 500 companies all at once. Very seamless. We're all told to put our 401ks and our savings in simple, safe, very broad, diversified index funds, right?
Correct.
Well, did you ever think about who controls those ETFs? Has that even crossed your mind?
A little bit, yeah. Mostly when I think about, you know, which of the versions of those S&P 500 funds do I buy? Mm-hmm. You know, I have like the VOO, which is supposed to be Vanguard. I don't know if you're going to tell me something different. Mm-hmm. I have the JP Morgan high yield distribution. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming JP Morgan is doing that one. Mm-hmm. Then I also have QQQ, which is Invesco. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, outside of that, no, I don't necessarily think who's pulling the strings, if that's where you're going, of a lot of these things. No.
Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of these ETFs out there, they're actually built and managed by BlackRock, which is why they've been able to garner so much in the assets under management, right? And on the surface, this maybe doesn't sound like that big of a deal. Like, okay, you know, maybe Charles Schwab is your brokerage account. They manage all your assets. Maybe Vanguard is the ETF that you own. What's the big deal? Why are we talking about this? Well, here's a tricky thing that most people don't understand about ETFs. You are giving up one really important thing versus owning a stock outright yourself. And that's actually voting shares of the company. So if you buy one share of, say, Amazon, you know, you as a shareholder technically can go to the shareholder meeting and vote for what the company should be doing. If you think the CEO should be fired or not, or a board member should be added, or the Amazon should get into a business or out of it, you have a vote. And usually individual shareholders, I mean, it's not really going to move the needle unless you really own a substantial chunk of the company, right? So most people, most regular, everyday retail investors like you and me, you know, we don't really think about our voting rights.
We're not going to do a corporate takeover.
We're not going to do a corporate takeover.
No. Yeah.
Exactly. But when you're BlackRock and you're running these ETFs, you're basically getting a retail person to invest in your ETF and you're giving them the economic reward of the underlying stocks. But if you're BlackRock, you're keeping the power, you're keeping the voting rights. And that's where things start getting really interesting. So this list of companies that we just went through, they basically own somewhere between 5 and 10% of literally just about every major company in the world.
Now, interesting question here for you. So I listened to the Acquired podcast about, so that was the LVMH one with Bernard Arnault, who has come up a couple times in this. Mm-hmm. And he, when he's taken over a company, eventually tries to get a certain percentage of voting stock, which I think mm-hmm. is like 31 or 32 or 33%. I can't remember.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So does it actually give them much power unless they actually get a pretty high percentage of stock? Like, it does 5 or 10% of owning Apple or McDonald's yeah. or any of these others that you actually mentioned give them mm-hmm. much actual power when it comes to how a corporation acts?
Yeah. So 5% of a company is still substantial because there's two things that you can do with it. So one, you can really rile up the shareholder base to vote one way or another. I mean, 5% could be the difference between something passing and not passing, right? That is a pretty substantial amount. I mean, if during whoever runs the next presidential election, if you could guarantee somebody an extra 5%, you can probably guarantee that they're going to win if it's the two leading people in the race, right? So it is meaningful in that regard. But where it's also meaningful is if somebody decide to start dumping shares, 5% of it is a lot to dump all at once. Swing. There isn't that much float of a lot of these shares out there. So if, say again, somebody had 5% of Amazon stock and they decide to sell it all within just a couple of days, I wouldn't be surprised if the actual share price might drop like 40, 50%, right? And then add on top of it that when it's one company that owns so many shares in all these other companies, they also have power with your competitors. So that's where something really interesting starts happening. They have the ability to sort of like be the puppet master and pull the strings between all these companies. So let's say there's two companies that are really going head to head with each other and really like trying to undercut each other on price, and they both are doing, you know, really poorly because all their margins are going down to zero because they keep on competing with each other.
So Uber and Lyft back in the heyday.
Exactly. But if there was like a magical force that told them both, hey, together you guys make a monopoly, both of you guys raise your price at the same rates, don't drop your rates, create a yeah. monopoly, all of a sudden both of their profits start skyrocketing, right? So if you're in a like a oligopoly, three companies together that have a monopoly on the market. So let's say,
isn't that illegal though, Ronak?
Yeah, that absolutely is illegal. But I mean, if you're running $10 trillion and you're donating to basically every political campaign out there, I mean, are you telling me that
really going to go after you?
Yeah, are you telling me that nothing illegal happens in this world?
So are you saying Larry Fink is like a mafia boss? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying he has potential to be.
Interesting. Okay.
Right. Again, he's running $10 trillion, but I think there is a lot of like other things that he's been doing. Right. So he's on the board of the World Economic Forum. He's been pushing this ESG agenda, which has gotten a lot of controversy.
Mm-hmm.
So ESG, that stands for environmental, social, and good governance, which all sounds great. You want your companies to be environmentally sound, friendly to their shareholders, diverse. You want them good governance. All that kind of stuff sounds great, but behind the scenes, you know, you can really pull the strings on like what technologies or what type of companies are actually going to make it over time and which ones aren't. Right. So like
the one of the things that I think of when ESG comes up is mm-hmm. in the All In podcast, they talked mm-hmm. about that, and Chamath talked about that mm-hmm. specifically. I can't remember which country he's. Do you know which country Chamath is from? I can't remember.
Pakistan.
So he was talking about how basically like these emerging economies, you know, if they're trying mm-hmm. to follow ESG requirements mm-hmm. like internationally, mm-hmm. they basically like destroy their own economy, which is really interesting because they just can't afford to do some of these things. Mm-hmm. And you have like the US and other major countries that, you know, mm-hmm. they say they're going to follow like these ESG guidelines and things, but don't mm-hmm. because
so
they don't
want
to destroy their economy.
Right. But like, why are they paying so much attention to ESG to begin with?
I'm guessing you're going to tell me Larry Fink.
Larry Fink, he's just so powerful. You kind of have to, you know, bend the knee to the quote unquote mafia lord. Yeah. I mean, like I think the environmental angle is so interesting here, right? Like when you look at the top ESG companies, like the top 10, how is Tesla not in the top 10, but ExxonMobil is?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Doesn't make any sense.
I'm pretty sure a lot of like the oil companies are in some of those top lists. Yeah, right. Which tells me it's either really easy to game that system mm-hmm. or it's just a money thing that you say you're doing things and I don't know. We might have to do a full episode on ESG, actually.
Right, right. Maybe. But I think that's so interesting that like these oil and gas companies are in the top 10 of ESG. They can easily compete with each other and slash prices and just have a race to the bottom. But somehow ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, ConocoPhillips, they all have very even profit margins.
So why does Larry Fink care so much about ESG then? Like, what is your theory behind that?
That's a good question. I don't think he's run by money. I don't think he's looking to gain as net worth as possible. I think he's built for influence. He just wants to control the world, and that's what he's doing. I don't think there's any sort of end game. My personal guess, I obviously have never met him. I don't know him, but you know, this is kind of like the Joker in the Batman movie where it's like,
See the world burn.
Some people just want to see the world burn. I'm not saying he wants to see the world burn, but I think he just wants power for power's sake. And he clearly has quite a bit of it.
Interesting.
So one question that this does raise in my mind is going back to the angel investing and entrepreneurship world, right? I think it's important to know who your investors are, right? So Greg, when you and your wife were running FlipMD, I think you had a pretty good idea of who all your investors were, who had shares.
Technically, none of them had shares, Ronak. Technically,
tell me.
None of them did. So interesting thing, if you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and listen to the All About Safes episode we did. A safe is not a share. You don't get equity in the company. You get future equity. So technically, nobody had shares in the company, I guess, until we sold it. So the moment of the transaction, you had shares, and then you gave them up when you signed the document saying, we know, we're selling the company. Mm-hmm. Anyways, but yes, we knew exactly who our investors were. Yeah.
Yeah. So like even the most giant companies in the world, the Apples, the Disneys, the Johnson & Johnsons, they still have to deal with activist investors every now and then, mm-hmm. or just people that are causing them a ruckus or making them do things that maybe they don't ultimately want to do. And I think for a startup founder, I think it's really important to know who owns the shares, everything from employees to investors to advisors, whoever it is. I think it's really important to build relationships with people that you trust and are not going to, you know, engage in frivolous lawsuits or, you know, clearly lie to you for their own financial gain. I mean, I'd rather work with somebody that's less competent, but honest and trustworthy because—
Ronak, let me ask you a question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So something that I always come back to after talking to a lot of founders and taking investment pitches and stuff like that, and, mm-hmm. and just thinking through, you know, companies like, let's take Stripe, for example. Mm-hmm. So Stripe is a gigantic company. They've processed billions and billions of dollars of revenue. Mm-hmm. They have talked about going public for so long, right? Mm-hmm. Since like 2020. And they probably missed the IPO window, which is honestly a little bit on them. Mm-hmm. My question is, why, you know, you had Elon Musk buy Twitter. He took it private immediately. Mm-hmm. Why are companies not going private? Like, there are so many issues with being a public company, mm-hmm. from activist investors that can just go on the open market and buy your shares,
right,
to swinging valuations and things like that. Like, especially older companies like a Nike or mm-hmm. somebody else, that they've had their liquidity event. Mm-hmm. They've probably diversified their portfolio. The founder is probably not in a CEO role anymore. Like, why don't more companies turn back and go private again? Like,
yeah.
What is the reason that you stay public?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think there's a few reasons why companies stay public. One, it's actually really difficult to pull off financially. I mean, for Twitter, you had to have the richest person in the world and have him give over a good chunk of his net worth to take Twitter private. And Twitter is a tiny company when you compare that to the likes of a Visa, right?
Yeah.
So in order to just get the capital to acquire all of the outstanding shares to take a private is extraordinarily difficult. And I think, you know, Twitter went private at around $44 billion. Mm-hmm. Once you start passing, you know, 50, 60, 70, $100 billion, I mean, it's going to take a Herculean task to pull that off. So just from a financial aspect, being able to put enough raise enough capital debt financing whatever you're doing, it's going to be extremely difficult to do. The second thing is that most of the CEOs of publicly traded companies are professional CEOs at this point. They're not the original founders, right? Mm-hmm. And honestly, they're just looking to cash out. They're looking at their bottom line, their paycheck, and taking a company private is not going to do anything for their bottom line. Keeping the company public and increasing the dividend and actually selling extra shares to raise capital for the company is actually probably going to do more for them. So taking it private probably would not be in most CEOs' best interest, especially for the non-founder CEOs.
Yeah, it's just interesting to think about. Like, there are some huge companies mm-hmm. that are private mm-hmm. that you have no idea how well they're actually doing. Mm-hmm. They're in the background
yeah.
and they can kind of just do whatever they want because right. there's no prying eyes, which it's just kind of an interesting like right. dynamic. Like we talked about Epic, right? Mm-hmm. That's a private company that was built in like the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. They've never thought about going public and I don't think they ever will. And like we've talked about, and my theory is Microsoft will try to acquire them, but mm-hmm. like that sounds like a great world to be in, right?
Oh, yeah.
You do whatever you want to do. You probably pay your employees quite well because, mm-hmm. you know, if you're never going to go public, there's no liquidation event. Mm-hmm. So you're going to just have to pay more in salary likely to retain top talent mm-hmm. and not have RSUs and stock options and all that kind of stuff. It's just kind of like an interesting yeah. thing. The people that build huge companies that clearly could go public mm-hmm. and could have a nice liquidity event for themselves versus the people that just say, you know what, I don't want to have to deal with all the crap that goes on with mm-hmm. being a public CEO. Because I remember when we were selling the company, like we talked to some people high up in some of these companies that are public. And it's like, I got on a call with a public company. I think it was the CTO or COO. I can't remember. And he was like, yeah, we're doing like basically the investor parade where they go around to all of their top investors, all these large, you know, institutional capital funds like a BlackRock and, you know, having to answer a shit ton of questions about, what are you guys doing? What's your growth rate? Like all of these things that you just don't think about as a startup or a private company. It's like mm-hmm. you might have a quarterly board meeting as a startup that lasts for an hour or two versus like you're doing a week long's worth of like investor meetings and mm-hmm. updating the public on how you're doing and like making sure all of your financials are perfectly buttoned up for, you know, your quarterly investor update and things like that. It just mm-hmm. sounds like such a headache and so much work.
Right. Absolutely. So I think you're right. It is quite a headache being a publicly traded company. If you think about some of the companies that are private, everything from In-N-Out Burger to Patagonia to Rolex mm-hmm. watches to Legos, right? There's a lot of companies that are private that are still really well known. But the interesting thing about those companies, they have to be very profitable for it makes sense to be able to afford paying all of their employees and having a little bit of return for whoever is the owner, right? When you take a company public,
which would be a fantastic public company.
Which would be a fantastic, but you can take a company public. You can take a company public without any profits, right?
True. Look at
Vivian. So if you are looking to just like flip a company and cash out, going through an M&A transaction or an IPO is going to be a much quicker route than like building a steady cash flow business.
Speaking of like, Ronak, why do people buy public stocks mm-hmm. that you're just like, that's never going to do anything? Like some of these SPACs that came out and, you know, dropped in 97% in value. Like, why would you even buy that? Like, are you really just speculating that in this zero interest world that we were in, that it's just going to keep going up and to the right, even though they have no actual product in market that they're selling? Like, is it just, we're going to take a flyer on this? Like, you have enough people doing that it buoys the stock price? Like,
yeah,
I don't understand how that works.
Absolutely. And we should do an entire episode on meme stock investing at some point. But absolutely. I mean, it's the same reason AMC, that, like, you know, you and I have invested in startup companies, right? Some people could look at that as insane. Like, how could you invest in a company that's nothing but two people in a PowerPoint presentation? That's insane versus investing in Coca-Cola that's churning out profits left and right. You guys are insane making that investment, right? But, you know,
but I feel like the insanity levels are different, right? When you say, okay, I'm going to invest in a company that's 3 months old that has an interesting idea versus a company that's like 2 years old that has raised hundreds of millions of dollars, but they still don't have a working product. Mm-hmm. Like that sounds like more insane to me than taking a flyer on a couple founders.
But you also have to remember that not everybody is an accredited investor and has the ability to invest in startups, but they really like seeing those huge, you know, 100,000x returns on your investment. And I think a lot of them are thinking to themselves, where else are you going to get that unless you invest? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I would say investing in startups is largely the same thing. I mean, you're taking a gamble and hoping that what their presentations and everything come true.
Thinking like if I'm a public market investor or if I'm just a person, like, am I really, when, again, I don't want to pick on Rivian because I've actually seen their vehicles out in the real world now, but that's the only one that comes to mind.
Yeah.
And I know their stock has gone down significantly, even though they're actually producing things, which is really interesting too. But like, if I'm looking for a stock to buy, I have $100,000 in my brokerage account that I'm just waiting to put into a company. Mm-hmm. Why would I bet on Rivian versus putting it into something else that is, you know, like an ETF? Like, I just don't understand who actually buys the stocks.
But Greg, I don't get it. Like, you and I have looked at an electric plane company.
Sure.
They did not have any electric planes for us to fly around in, right? So why would anyone invest in that company when you can invest in, like you're saying, an ETF?
But again, it's different to me, right? So if I'm looking at public companies, I want to see something. Like, if it's a private company that was just started.
The only difference between a public company and a private company is that they're probably a little bit further along in their evolution, right? Yes. So like, maybe the public company can say that, like, we're not just two people. We've already hired 100 engineers and we've already raised, you know, $200 million, right? And the startup can't say that. It still is the same idea where, believe our PowerPoint presentation, we're making this fantastic future. And maybe it actually comes true sometimes, right? Like companies like Amazon and Tesla, these were pretty small companies.
Specifically, SPACs that have done well.
I don't know. Can you think of one?
Okay.
I can't think of one. SPACs have been a relatively new thing. They haven't been new. They've been popularized in the last couple of years. But like, is it insane to think that some of these SPACs 10 years from now might actually turn into legit company, like legitly sized companies? Like, take like a Robinhood, for example. I know they've gotten a lot of flack, but they still have a lot of users. If they build on what they have, they SPAC'd. Yeah.
I thought they did a direct listing.
Yeah, I could be wrong there. But still, like that class of companies.
I'm just looking through the list of all SPACs.
You just mentioned.
I don't know any of them. Yeah, I mean, Rivian's the only one that I honestly. It looks like, okay, so Forge, we know Forge.
Forge.
They SPAC'd, and yeah, they've gone down quite a bit. Hyperfine, I actually know Hyperfine. They actually have a real product. Hyperfine, so if anybody, I mean, this is an interesting one to physicians. So Hyperfine, they make basically like a portable MRI that you can bring into an ICU and actually take MRI images of a patient's head without having to wheel them down to the MRI scanner, which is really nice.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Pear Therapeutics, which is now going bankrupt. Yeah, man. Nextdoor, WeWork.
Yeah. So
like, actually, honestly, it seems like this is similar to like, okay, a SPAC feels similar to the feeling of a startup that is trying to crowdsource funding.
Yeah, like, I think that's correct.
That feels like the equivalent.
Yeah, I think that's
BioWorks.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. And I just want to loop back on one thing that you said earlier, Greg, that like, why would a company want to be public? It's a big headache. And I think that's actually why companies like Berkshire Hathaway are still able to acquire companies, right? When the greatest investor of all time comes to you and says he wants to buy out your company and you're on the other side of that table, what are the odds that you're getting a good deal? Right? Like, probably not. Like, he's probably wanting to buy out your company because he sees something that you don't, right? Yeah. But people still like to do it because being part of the Berkshire Hathaway umbrella means that you don't have to do those calls with the investors. You don't have to, you know, answer.
And also, if it's a stock deal,
the world,
there's a significant stock deal in Berkshire stock.
Right.
I'll take that.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, the only ones that I see are like SoFi, also SPAC'd, and 23andMe. So, yeah. I mean, honestly, not most SPACs, it seems like, have done quite poorly.
Right. But again, like, if you fast forward 10 years from now, could SoFi be a company that like legitly competes with a Bank of America, maybe, I don't know, but there's at least potential there. And I think that's what people are betting on, that like, you know, I can't invest in a startup company because I'm not an accredited investor. Let me get to the closest thing I can so that way I can 1000x my money.
Yeah, or like the people that do like penny stocks and they're just waiting on like one of those therapeutic companies to come out of like an FDA cleared drug and then just like go crazy. Yeah,
exactly.
And go to a dollar and get 100x. So why do you know about Larry Fink? Let's go back to Larry Fink. And also, why the hell is his net worth only $1 billion if he has, if he's the CEO and founder of a $99 billion market cap company? Like, why? Did he really just get diluted down?
That's a good question. I actually don't know the history of the dilution rounds of BlackRock. But again, I this goes to my speculation. So Larry Fink, if you're listening to this podcast, feel free to come on the podcast. We'll love to have you on and chat with you, and you can straighten out the record. But my guess is he really doesn't want to climb the ranks on the Forbes richest people list. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's purposely trying to keep his net worth as low as possible.
He's like shielding it and put it into different places or something. Exactly. There's no way this guy's only worth a billion.
Or even giving it away, donating it to charity. I don't know what it could be, but again, I think the power is more interesting than the money here. Because I mean, if you're controlling 5 to 10% of again every major company in the world, I mean, you're playing a different game.
It's also such a round number, Ronak, like $1 billion.
It's too round of a number, right?
There has to be a reason he only is. Right. Like, I either don't believe that number, or he's done such a good job of, like, you know, we've talked about a little bit, like, how do you pass off wealth to your kids and to your heirs? Right. And, like, you can gift over, like, 17,000 per kid, per person in a couple. So it's like, maybe he's passed it on to, like, a million generations in the future.
right.
Every single year. And that's like how he's, I don't know, man, but that's,
that's maybe. Very
interesting. He only owns 0.7% of BlackRock.
Which is so wild.
CNBC article. Why the hell does he only own that much?
Right. Yeah. It's very interesting. And, I mean, the reason why I came across this was I was listening to one of the Berkshire Hathaway annual meetings from a few years ago, and Charlie Munger got asked the question of, like, what if everybody invested through indexing ETFs and nobody bought individual shares in companies anymore, right? Everybody just bought into, like, the S&P 500 is the only thing that you need to invest in, and close your eyes on everything else. What if the entire world moved there? And that question got me thinking, well, what would happen in that world, right? Who are the people? What are the companies that would really, really profit if just everybody moved away from single share ownership? And by far the number one name that I came across was Larry Fink. In that world, he would basically be a dictator of the world.
Yeah, it's interesting. So are you saying, like, the Vanguard S&P is also run by BlackRock?
Vanguard is not. They also have roughly $9 to $10 trillion of assets under management, but they have a very unique ownership structure where actually their shareholders in the ETFs are the shareholders of Vanguard itself. So there is no external shareholders of Vanguard. The original founder of Vanguard, Jack Bogle, he was actually the creator of the original index fund. It was his Princeton thesis paper. We'll leave a link to a YouTube video of Jack Bogle in the show notes. Really, really smart guy. He passed away a couple of years ago. But I think he came off as somebody that was incredibly just wanting to do the right thing for humanity. He did not seem like he had a big ego trip or a power grab or a money thing. It was just like, how do you make the world more efficient? And that's why he set up Vanguard to be that self-ownership model, where again, there are no independent external shareholders of Vanguard. So Greg, if you own an ETF of Vanguard, technically you are one of the owners of Vanguard, the company.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I also just answered my question. Why does he only own 0.7%? So this is from an article from the Financial Review, which I'll put into the show notes. Fink has trailed in personal wealth because he only owns a tiny piece of BlackRock, 0.7%. Back in 1994, Blackstone sold its stake in Fink's outfit as Schwartzman railed against dilution because of Fink's desire to award new hires equity in the business to lure them from top banks. Since then, Fink's continued to spread ownership among his employees and used BlackRock stock to make key acquisitions, including the $15 billion purchase of Barclays Global Investors Unit in 2009. So basically, it sounds like he wanted to get the top talent Mm-hmm. And so he basically sounds like he must have created gigantic stock option pools mm-hmm. and just diluted himself away.
Right. And as the founder and CEO, he retains, you know, he's on top of the company and he can sort of dictate how things are done. But again, giving up the shares, he's kind of like giving up the financial incentive.
Interesting. It goes on to talk about how Blackstone, do they have any seller's remorse when they got out of BlackRock, which is mm-hmm. interesting, like Blackstone, yeah. BlackRock. Yeah. Seller's remorse, ? Schwartzman once said that unloading BlackRock was a heroic mistake. Today, he's far richer than Fink, but in terms of assets and stock performance, BlackRock has won.
Exactly. So Blackstone won in terms of net worth and financials. BlackRock won in terms of power.
Why are their names so close, Renek?
I think that Blackstone was on purpose. Versus
BlackRock. Yeah. Is it? Is that yeah, like a Tesla yeah. and a Nikola?
Yeah.
Also, that's another great SPAC that has done absolutely nothing. Nikola, if you don't know what that is, go up and look up Nikola. They're basically trying to do, like, I think hydrogen semis, which ultimately, basically, the guy went on to a podcast and basically said he was a fraud within the podcast.
Hydrogen semis, and you're naming the company Nikolai. How awkward is that?
Yeah. Basically just trying to ride the coattails of Elon Musk and right. not really understanding what they do. Anyways, that was an interesting meandering episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast.